with cheese on it.
This week's Torah portion discusses God telling Abraham and Sarah that they're going to have a child. That's this week's Torah portion, which we read on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. So what happens is that Sarah says, when God tells him this, she says, first of all, I'm too old. Right? She was like 90, and Abraham was 100, and my master, meaning Abraham, is too old. So how are we going to have a child? So,
haven't they heard of immaculate conception?
Artificial insemination.
Right. Maybe. Then what happens is that when God tells Abraham, right, because the first conversation happened, Abraham was not there. He didn't hear what Sarah said. He said that Sarah said, God said that Sarah said, that I'm too old to have a child. And nevertheless, I'm going to grant you a child. The question is, God left out something, right? He left out the fact that she said that Abraham also is too old. So why did God leave that part out? When he's repeating the conversation to Abraham, he leaves out the part about Sarah saying that that not just I'm old to have a child, but also my husband's too old to have a child. So the Talmud says that you see from here that the reason that God did not repeat what Sarah said in full is to preserve peace between husband and wife. So he changed the truth, so to speak.
He just did a mere omission.
Right, that's a good point, right. So he didn't commit a lie. It was an omission of the full truth, right? So that the relationship would remain intact. Why would that be such a problem, the commentaries ask? Because she is old and he is old. Like, that's just the truth. So she was just saying the truth. So why would that be such an issue, even to repeat what she said? So the answer is that there's still like a level of sensitivity that unfortunately spouses don't always reach, but ideally they should, which is that she, even giving the impression that she thinks or that Abraham seems to her like an old man, would perhaps offend him in some way. That, oh, he's too old. Yeah, it's true, but, oh, she said that about me? So, again, you know, so not that they never quarreled or anything like that, but in this instance, the reason God did it was to preserve peace. So one could see that, you know, when nowadays, when it comes to our relationships, especially between spouses, but even between parents and children, one could see the merit in bending the truth, which we'll see in a second, is normally a value that we uphold, but in certain circumstances, to preserve the peace, we allow it. So, what's an example of that, a modern-day example, is if a parent, if the mother, you know, tells the son to do something, and the father disagrees with what the son is doing. He doesn't want the son to do what the mother asked. So he confronts the son. He says, who told you to do that? That's ridiculous. Don't do that. So if he would say, the mother, so unless they had a perfectly solid relationship, the parents, and, you know, it wouldn't, you know, matter that much. But in a normal case, when there's always, it's always best to err on the side of peace between spouses. So he is permitted, the child's permitted to say, oh, you know, my friend told me to do that, or the neighbor told me to do it, or my rabbi told me to do it, even though that's not true. It was the mother. But again, what would be the point, right? So what would be the point? Might as well bend the truth a little bit to preserve the relationship between the spouses. And so that's an important point that I said, is that what would be the point? So, meaning truth is important, but perhaps it's only important when not saying the truth can be harmful to someone, right? So we're going to see a lot of examples of where truth can be bent, because not only is it a positive thing, it creates peace, but also it doesn't hurt anyone, right? And so the value of keeping peace would override absolute truth. Let's start from the beginning, which is, so we're going to see some Talmudic arguments about this topic, and then we're going to see some more Torah, from the Bible, other examples of where people change the truth for the sake of peace. There's a very interesting Talmudic debate between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, right, who was the house of Shammai, the house of Hillel. The house of Hillel were known to be somewhat more lenient in their rulings and their outlook on life, and Beit Shammai was more absolutist, right? If they thought that was the law, and even if they thought, oh, well, there could be a more lenient view, but we think this is at least the truth, or at least the stringent view that one should follow. So you see that on and on, the debate between Hillel and Shammai about what they think is absolutely the correct thing, whereas Beit Hillel takes more lenient approaches. So you see that over here. So the Talmud asks, Ketubot 17, right? This is kind of, we know this, it's like a famous song, sung at weddings, right? It says, Ketzan Meraktan Lefnei Akala, how do you dance, how does one dance in front of the bride? So what does that mean, how do you dance? Like a line dance, right? A hoedown, square dance, foxtrot? No, it means, as Rashi comments, how does one praise the bride? In other words, back then, we don't really do this nowadays. Nowadays, we just sing the song. We'll see what the full song is, what the full line is. But they used to apparently sing songs of praise unique to each bride at a wedding. And, you know, as part of the celebration, right, there's an idea to celebrate and to make the groom and bride happy, to gladden them. And so they used to say specific praises of the bride as they're dancing, as they're singing. Again, nowadays we don't really do this. We just kind of sing standard tunes. But back then they used to do that. So fine. So Beit Shammai says Kala Kimochahi, meaning what should we say about the bride? We should praise the bride as she is, emphasizing her good qualities. You know, the bride could be, you know, beautiful. You say she's beautiful, right? The bride has a good singing voice, right? The bride is very smart, right? The bride is very accomplished, right? She has a PhD, or she's a medical doctor, or she's very kind, right? She volunteers all over. So, great, beautiful. So that's, you say in your praises and your singing, you know, that she's, you know, very smart, she's very kind, or she's very beautiful, or it could be all three, or it could be two out of three, it could be something else. Like, whatever the bride has, that's what you sing about. Fine. Says Beit Hillel, no. You always say the following, or some form of the following. Kala Na'ava Chasuda, a fair and attractive bride, right? Chasuda, like from the language of chesed. In other words, when God bestows, like, that a person has an attractive, like, aura to them. So that's like chut shel chesed. That's like chen. That's God granting them, like, grace. Right, I think it says about Queen Esther that she found favor in people. It's not just it's beauty, but it's beauty with like a, you know, you could have beautiful people, but then you have certain people that have a beauty that like
intelligence,
personality.
No. It's It's within beauty, but it's something like in their eyes that's a welcoming beauty, not like not just like beautiful. It's like a beautiful that's like that brings people in, that doesn't like not offend people, does not override people. So anyway, the point is that's what you say about every single bride. Now, all brides they say are beautiful at their wedding, which is true. I mean they. Just the fact that they're happy on that day, but they, brides, they do get, a lot of help and makeup and hair, and that's beautiful, right? That's what it should be. But listen, objectively, some women have qualities, and some men as well have some qualities and not others. And attraction is just one of them. That's just the truth. It's not bad or good. It's just is objective truth. So, but Beit Hillel would say she's a fair bride. Listen, even if that's not her best quality, her best quality is that she's studying to be a medical doctor. The attractive part is not, on the top of the list. But that's fine, right? There's nothing wrong with that. But Beit Hillel say that you actually say that about every single bride. Says Beit Shammai, wait a second. In a case where the bride was, God forbid, lame or, had some, physical deformity, handicap, we would say nowadays, to be, politically correct, which I think is not just politically correct, I think it's the nice way to say it. So, if that was the case, would you call her a fair and attractive bride? Meaning, how far does it go? One second.
Personality.
Good. Personality. Okay, we're going to get to that in a second. You're on to something. Very good. But let's just, at this point in the Talmud, the assumption is that Beit Shammai is saying, come on, she's not the most attractive. And if she actually had like a limp, would you still say that? But the Torah says, keep away from a false matter, midvar sheker tirchak. Stay away from something false, and you're saying something false about her because it's not true. Okay, we're gonna get to the responses, like what you were saying about subjectivity, etc. But Beit Shammai, as we said, is absolutist. They're very objective, right? The truth, right? Nothing but the truth. And here you're straying from the truth. It just is what it is. That's their perspective. Says Beit Hillel to Beit Shammai, the response from Beit Hillel is, no, according to your statement, if you acquired something inferior from the market, right? So should someone praise it and enhance its value in his eyes, or should he condemn it and diminish its value, right? You have to say that you praise it, you enhance it in his eyes, and you refrain from causing him anguish. In other words, what should you do? You go into a restaurant. Someone invites you over for tea and cookies, and the cookies aren't the most tasty you've had in your life, or whatever it is. The tea is bland. So should you tell them, "Hi, it was nice, spending time with you, but your cookies were not so good, and your tea was bland"? No, you don't say that. Like that's not the right thing to do. And the Talmud says, from here you see that a person's disposition should be empathetic with mankind. In other words, people should treat everyone with courtesy, respect, and there's no need to tell people everything,
Like it is.
You don't need to, right. It's the society, well, we'll get to that in a second, but society doesn't function that way, or else everyone would hate each other if everyone really said what they thought. Again, there's not to say that sometimes you have to speak truth to power or whatever, but that's like when there's like a higher purpose. But just in everyday conversation, you treat each other with respect and you don't say things that are totally unnecessary, even if they're the truth. So that's what Beit Hillel says. It's their wedding. It's their happiest day. Why would you say about the wife, oh, she's She's very smart, you know, she's very kind. She's very kind. She's very smart. And but at the
beautiful.
One second, but at the last wedding, everyone said, she's very beautiful, right? She's very pretty. So last night's wedding you said beautiful, and the week before you said beautiful. And tonight, you know, everyone's the same people are here, we're saying she's smart. Come on. Like, you know, people aren't dumb. That's not a nice thing. We should say she's also beautiful. That's what Beit Hillel says. Now the question is, right, so first of all, when Beit Shammai says, praise her as she is, like we said, it means Lefi Yofya v'Chashivuta Mekal Sanosa. We praise her according to her specific beauty and her specific qualities. Meaning, if she is beautiful, Beit Shammai would say, hey, you could say she's beautiful. If objectively she's not, then we say something else. The question is, well, why is Beit Hillel so, you know, against what Beit Shammai says? Beit Shammai we're not saying anything bad about her. We're just praising her unique qualities. Like, she's kind and she's very intelligent. What's wrong with that? So I already kind of gave away the answer based on what I just said, which is by omission, one understands things, right? You read between the lines. So reading between the lines, again, I gave the example that, you know, these two weddings, you said one thing. This wedding, you say something else. So that's what the Tosfos say, which is that if she has first of all, even according to Beit Shammai, if she has a blemish, Yishtaku, you remain quiet. And Beit Shammai would agree with that. You know, if, you know, she's not kind, if she's miserly, or, again, physically, if she has a limp, right? Because that was discussed. If she has a limp, would you say she's beautiful? But even Beit Shammai would say, we're not going to say she has a limp. We never said to say that. We said to praise her unique qualities, even if it's not beauty. So what's Beit Hillel, what's their problem? Like, why do they have such an issue with that? So, Inami Yishabchu Davar Nash Yeshba, Kigon Be'ineha, Obiyadeha, Imheim Yafos. Right? So, another option is Beit Shammai saying, even physically, she has beautiful hands, beautiful hair. So, even say that. You can, a woman can, you know, not every, some people are totally attractive people, just objective. One second. We're still talking about physical. Some people are physically, like, perfect all over, and then some people have, you know, very nice hair, even if the rest of them is not. Okay? So, but say that, praise her hair. Says Beit Hillel, come on. By omission, by praising her hair and her hair only, you know, what do we infer from that? You know, you're not praising her beauty as a whole. You're picking one or two things, her hands. Why are you saying just her hands? So that's going to be embarrassing. And again, like, people are intelligent and they can understand what you're saying. So again, we're saying this is like a praise in front of everyone, right? We're singing this in front of everyone. So people are, you know, it's not like a private thing. You know, you go over to her. This is in front of everyone. So everyone's going to hear it. So so the answer is that Beit Hillel says, Yishabchana legamre, you praise her totally. Because if you praise only one thing, then we can infer that the other stuff you're mean to denigrate. You're meaning not to praise. Okay? So, what about truth? So this gets to what we were saying before, right? What about truth, right? Doesn't Beit Shammai have a point? You're not saying the truth. So we're going to have different answers to that. One answer is, it's not lying, simply because Darkei Shalom, the way of peace. She's not you know, she's not perfectly beautiful. Who cares? Right? The husband, you know, is marrying her. So just praise her as beautiful and leave it at that, right? What's the problem? Oh, you're saying an untruth. Who cares? Again, as we saw before, and we'll see more examples, with Abraham and Sarah, God bent the truth also. He didn't say the whole truth. Now, Beit Shammai will say, well, wait a second. The Abraham thing, like you said, he just omitted. He didn't say anything untrue. Here, we're actually saying that she's beautiful, even though she's not. So that's where Beit Shammai would maybe respond back. But Beit Hillel maintains, nah, it doesn't matter. Commission, omission, you could say, if you want to call it a white lie or whatever, for a purpose. For the purpose of peace, you can override truth. Okay, that's what the medieval commentary Ritva, that's what he says. So, now, one idea is as follows. The other commentaries aren't so, right, so according to what we just said, Beit Hillel allows you to bend the truth for peace, bottom line. And that's why they allow it. Beit Shammai maybe would not. Other commentaries aren't so comfortable with the fact that Beit Hillel is saying, basically saying that we should say things that are not true, and they give alternative explanations, which, according to these explanations, you're not lying at all. Meaning, until now, we thought that you were lying, meaning you were saying something untrue, but that's okay. But the following commentaries say, no, you're not saying anything untrue. So it's not a problem at all. So like you said, one approach is to say, subjectively, to him, she's beautiful. Right? You know, everyone finds, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Right? And the groom obviously finds her attractive, and that's all that matters, right? Who cares about anything else? We're talking about this couple. So when you say she's beautiful to the husband, she is, right? So that's it. But again, that's an important point, which is that according to this, they explain Beit Hillel is not saying that you should say something untrue, because it is true. Subjectively, it is true. And so that would have parameters in other cases, perhaps, where maybe Beit Hillel would agree that you shouldn't bend the truth if you cannot explain what you said in any other way except for that they bent the truth. Because here you could. Here you could say that really they told the truth. What's another approach? Another approach is to say, like you said, when we say she's beautiful, we don't mean physically, we mean personality, which also is true. In most cases, most people, men or women, bride or groom, are nice people. So you could say she's a nice person, and she's even a beautiful person, right? People say that. They'll say he's a beautiful human being, right? She's a beautiful human being. So that's what they're saying, right? That's what they're saying. And a third approach. A third approach is to say that you're not praising her at all. What you're doing is you're saying a standard praise for all brides, right? In other words, when Beit Hillel says, what do we sing in front of the bride? A beautiful bride. We don't mean that she in particular is beautiful or is not beautiful. We're not talking about her. We're saying in general, like all brides are beautiful. So again, according to that, we're not bending the truth at all because it's just a standard song, right?
What about a shidduch?
A shidduch brings two people together, right? So, a shidduch means that someone thought that they were compatible. Yeah. So, in other words,
because maybe she's 35 and he's 45 and neither one are married.
Yeah.
So they put them together.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing
wrong.
Right, nothing wrong with that. And fine. Okay, so that's this back and forth again between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. How far you take this idea of bending the truth? So there's another approach, which is to say as follows: maybe the whole idea of telling the truth and staying away from a lie doesn't apply in everyday situations at all. Meaning, forget everything we just said until now. Biblically, when it says to stay away from falsehood, does that even mean you need to be truthful in every situation or only in certain situations? Which, according to that, if that's true, then there's really no problem at all. You know, if someone says, you know, how do I look in this dress? So you say, beautiful, right? You say beautiful. That's, even if it's, so the first approach is to say, well, that's not true. You don't. Okay, but there's no point in lying. There's no point in telling the truth about this idea because you're trying to make the person feel good. But now we're saying, maybe even if you are lying, it doesn't matter. So what do I mean? So it says, in the original source, the verse says, keep far from falsehood. Do not bring death onto those that are innocent and correct, because I will not acquit those that do wrong. In other words, this is connected to the idea that in a court case, one should not be a false witness. One should not lie, right? A lawyer should not lie, or witness should not lie under oath. A lawyer should not, you know, change the truth. I can't say that every lawyer adheres to the truth at all, but from the Torah's perspective, we're only talking about a court case, and that's what one of the commentaries say, that we're talking about a judge, right? We're talking about a witness. We're talking about a court case, and that's where it says, don't. Here he says specifically, a judge should not rule falsely. He knows that guy A is correct. He's concluded that based on his judgment. But he's going to rule for guy B. Either guy B is a wealthy guy in town and influential, and he's afraid of guy B, you know, doing something to him. Even though another verse says, do not be scared of any man when it comes to rendering judgment. Do what you think is right, and don't be intimidated. But human nature is that sometimes we are. So if he took a bribe, he's violating another prohibition of taking a bribe. But so for whatever reason, he rules like guy B. So that's what Torah is saying, don't do. Don't stay away from falsehood. Perhaps that leaves the door open for the idea that in a regular case, someone says, you know, how was the meatloaf? The cook says, your wife to a husband says, how was the meatloaf? And you didn't really care for it. But what's the point of saying you didn't like it? You say, oh, it was fine. It was good. Now, even saying it was fine, sometimes, you know, a spouse can pick up on that. Oh, it was just fine. Sometimes you say it's terrific. I see how it is. And they get mad anyway. So you could say it's terrific. Why? Because even if it is a lie, you can bend the truth for peace. And then maybe it doesn't even matter, because you are allowed to say untruths when it's not in a court case, meaning, and that's extended to damage. In other words, right, if someone says, hey, did that kid hit that baseball and break my window, which will cost me $500 to repair, and the kid says, because it's his friend, no, it wasn't him. It must have been someone else. It wasn't him. So the kid, let's say, even, you know, if it's an adult for sure, just violated this, because even though it wasn't a court case, but again, it's damage, right? It's, you're lying and you're causing someone damage. So that everyone agrees you can't do. But the meatloaf case isn't going to hurt anyone, right? So then maybe it's no problem to lie. Another question, going back to Beit Shammai about absolute truth, how far do you take that? Like we said, in society, would Beit Shammai really say that everyone should say what they think? And even if you're asked a question, like, again, the dress or the meatloaf, that you should say the absolute truth, how would they, like, it's hard to understand how far they take that. There's actually a concept called radical honesty, which I read, there's an article about it, which I could print out and hand out, which is very interesting, that a guy, he took this, there's this idea of radical honesty where you do like Beit Shammai, basically. In the secular world, they found Beit Shammai's approach to truth, which is that you always say the truth. So in the meatloaf case, you would say, honey, I love you. It was not good. It was terrible. The dress case, you know, I love you like a sister, but you look terrible in that dress. So that's radical honesty. That's the idea that maybe humans should be completely honest with one another, and somehow that's better for society. So he tried, this writer, he tries this out, and he adopts, he's a guy that he likes to try different things, social experiments. So he goes around and he tells everyone exactly the truth. Not what they want to hear, but what is the truth. And it's like he gets like excoriated for it. It doesn't work in society, right? Beit Shammai's approach doesn't work in society. Now again, to defend Beit Shammai in the wedding case, they're saying that you're not offending anyone by saying what you're saying, by praising a unique quality. They don't feel necessarily that you're hurting anyone, and you should adhere to the truth. And it's not like someone is saying, hey, is the bride, right? It's not like the song, according to them, goes, is the bride beautiful? No, she's not. No, that's not, it's much less hurtful than that. We said you can infer that it was hurtful, but it really wasn't hurtful at all. So that's, again, this tension, how we're trying to balance Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. There's another approach, which is that perhaps it does say, the biblical verse does say keep away from falsehood, and maybe that does extend to all circumstances. However, the rabbis were given the ability to apply when this verse applies. So in other words, the standard maybe is absolute truth on some level. But the rabbis can say, for the sake of peace, you can bend the truth. Right? They're able to interpret what it means, and for the betterment of society. When is it not okay to lie, and when is it okay, or when should one lie to preserve the peace? So, fine. Let's go through a couple more Talmudic, another Talmudic approach to this idea of bending the truth for peace, and then a couple other biblical examples as well. So another Talmudic statement, and there's a lot more than this, there's many examples, but one of them is as follows. Rabbi Joshua said as follows, in all my days, no one defeated me in verbal argument, right? In a what's it called, a tete-a-tete? A verbal dispute, meaning he always won the argument, right? He always had the best argument, except in three cases involving a woman, a young boy, and a young girl. So we're only going to do one of the stories because it's the story that's relevant to our discussion. Maybe a different time we can analyze the other two stories where he lost the argument to the young boy and the young girl. But in terms of the woman, the Talmud says, one time Rabbi Joshua was staying in a hotel, a bed and breakfast, and the hostess prepared a meal of beans, and the first day I ate them. Even though, according to the Talmud, that the proper etiquette, at least back then, was to leave a little on your plate, I'm not exactly sure why. Maybe to show that, like, you're not a glutton, or just to, I don't know, to show that you,
anyway,
to show that you enjoyed it. So the second day, he didn't, he ate everything and didn't leave anything over. That's not really, that's more tangential to the story. The third day, she oversalted them, right? They were too salty. He couldn't eat them. So what did he do? He didn't eat them. As soon as he tasted it, he's like, ugh. He spit it out, right? So she said, Rabbi, why aren't you eating? Yeah, you ate yesterday and the day before. What's wrong? So if he said that you oversalted them, it would make her feel bad. So what did he say instead? I already ate. I ate earlier. I'm not hungry, that's why. But so he avoids saying the answering her question honestly, because what's the point? Rather, you know, just make her feel good and make an excuse. And then she said, no, you should have not eaten this morning. Why'd you eat so much? You leave room for lunch, as you say to kids, right? Don't fill up on junk food. So obviously, maybe he didn't eat that day, and now he'll have to find something to eat. The whole thing was, he made the whole thing up. But, so what about truth? Why, he's a rabbi and he's lying? No, you can lie to bend, you can bend the truth in order to preserve peaceful relations between people. Fine. So, let's see one other, second. Yes, one example of a biblical idea where another, right, we had the Abraham case. Now let's see another case in the Bible when the truth is bent, right? So they sent the message to, okay, so this is a little background. So when the brothers, when the tribes, the 12 tribes, so not Benjamin because he wasn't involved in this, but I guess the other 10 tribes, we know had a dispute with Joseph, and it spills over years, and of course he's sold into slavery by them, right? We all know the story. So at the end of the life, at the last chapter in Genesis, at the very end, after Joseph makes it to Egypt and becomes the viceroy and achieves success over there, and then the brothers come back and he kind of runs them through the gamut to teach them a lesson. Again, that could be for future talks. Very interesting stuff. So they, you know, he forgives them at the end, and what happens at the very end, they say, before you die, right, because this is before Joseph passes away, your father, our father, the brothers say to him, left us the following instruction. Tell Joseph, forgive them. This is what he should. I urge you, the offense and the guilt of your brothers who treated you so harshly. Therefore, right, meaning they treated you not fairly, to put it lightly. But please forgive them as servants of the God of your father. And Joseph was in tears as they spoke to him, and he forgave them. The question is, we don't find in the text anywhere where Jacob told the sons to do this. It doesn't exist. So maybe you could say, maybe some, I'm not sure, but maybe some say that not everything in our tradition is in the Bible, right? We have a tradition that Abraham was thrown into the furnace because he refused to worship idols. That's that famous story that we teach kids is not actually in the Bible, and yet it's part of the tradition. It's Midrash. So anyway, maybe Midrash, maybe even though it's not in the text, maybe he did. But the common approach is to say they made it up. It wasn't, Jacob never said that Joseph had to forgive them. Keep in mind, Joseph and Jacob had a very strong relationship, perhaps more than any of the other brothers, primarily due to the fact that his mother was Rachel, who was the wife that Jacob wanted originally. So anyway, he never said it, right? Now, does that mean that he wouldn't want Joseph to forgive the brothers? No, and that's the point. For the sake of peace, they said, our father said, you know, you have to forgive us. Even if he didn't, because they're bending the truth. They're saying something, a commission even. They're saying something that's not true. But Joseph forgives them, then, you know, that's the best thing, and everyone can move on. So, they again, you see a clear example of, you know, bending the truth for the sake of peace. Okay, so... So we see, you know, we can imagine, as we've said before, many examples of this in modern society. So I have to say, I got a lot of these sources, not all of them, but a lot of them from a book by Mark Shapiro, who wrote a book, and the book is mainly about censoring Jewish texts that have uncomfortable messages for a variety of reasons. He goes through them all in the book. For many different reasons, certain, you know, books, you know, going back to the Talmud, which in the Bible, which we talked about today, but then there's also cases of in the medieval times up till modern times when books were censored, right? The book original in the first printing, the first edition said this or said that. And then when it was reprinted, you know, 5 years, 20 years later, 50 years later, it was censored. They took that passage out. And so why would they do that? So he goes through, perhaps it features one, the author, referring to another scholar, another sage, in not the warmest of terms. And so that's what he wrote, that's what he felt. And yet, 50 years later, when there's no, you know, the students or whoever's publishing it doesn't see a point in recording that he said about this rabbi. Everyone's, you know, gone already. And for students that, you know, maybe back then it was like okay to have a dispute between these two figures. But now we don't, just to rehash what happened makes no sense, right? So a modern reader who's picking the book up for the first time doesn't need to read that the author thought so such and such about this other sage. If you were to read that, the modern student, the modern reader would say, well, wait a second, that's what he said, right? What am I supposed to think about the author? What am I supposed to think about this other sage? It just creates machloket. It creates dispute where there doesn't need to be one. It was that was 300 years ago. Why should we need to have these thoughts? Again, you see that scholars had opinions. They were human beings. They were critical of one another, and they said so outright. And yet, the students, and this is what the book talks about at the end, is the value of truth more important than the value of preserving peace or making things right? And which is more important? And so it's obvious that a lot of editors and students thought that the idea of preserving peace and other reasons overrides just republishing everything that the book said originally without censorship, but because, you know, the censorship included not the greatest of things. Another example is if an author is the opposite, not that he denigrates another sage, but that he seems to praise another sage, another scholar, another rabbi. He quotes his work and he approves. But let's say that other scholar is connected with some other movement in Judaism or something like that, where students of the author, if they knew that the author favored or approved of this other figure, that would be very damaging spiritually for the reader, that they know that the... So that's, to me, that's that's maybe going a step further, where the first case, when he denigrates, there might not be any purpose to showing that he denigrated the other scholar. So you can understand maybe more about the censorship. But then the second case, where an author praises another scholar who might become taboo for his views on certain issues, to me, that's a more serious. To censor those passages would be to basically say that the author, no one would know that the author approved. But the author did approve. And maybe the author knows more than you. And maybe not knows more, but maybe we should value his opinion more than what people are saying nowadays. In other words, this sage that he approves of, maybe it's not true that he's bad or that he's taboo. Maybe it's more nuanced than that. Because you see that this other very respected scholar quotes him, he approves of him. So why not lay the truth out, right? Life is not black and white. There's complexity. Maybe this other figure has views that are problematic, but maybe he has other Torah insights that are very wonderful. And so people aren't black and white. So it doesn't mean that if the scholar quotes this other person that he approves of everything that he said, but maybe... So people need to learn that, right? That's the argument against censorship. People should see exactly what was written. And why should things be hidden from the reader? Other issues include more like sexual references. Again, going back maybe to the Bible, to the Talmud, and later, where the reader shouldn't read about these things. Even in the Talmud, it says that one should read a certain word in a certain way. And there's also this idea of a sofer, a scribe, maybe even, and this is like very controversial and its own topic, maybe even changing a word in the Bible to make it, seem more kosher. So tikkun sofrim, it's called, right? A scribal, fixing, which is like very fascinating because how can a scribe just change a word in the scroll? So these things do exist. And it goes back to our discussion today, which is, okay, the proponents of censorship would say, okay, you're right, you got us. We didn't tell the exact truth. But maybe we have a good reason. For example, if it's something is a reference to other nations, that might not be the best. So nowadays, in more modern times, when the relationship with that other nation is on good terms, why should we publish a book that indicates that we don't necessarily think of them in the warmest regard? That was back then. That's over, right? Nowadays, we want to establish good relationships. So maybe we'll take it out of the book. We'll take that line out of the book. And so proponents of censorship have their reasons, and yet when does it go too far, right? When does censorship, right, just totally distorting the truth do harm, right, and make things black and white when really they're gray, and, let the reader have a false impression of things when there's no reason to do that either. Let the truth, let the original work stand as it stood. So that's the big debate about censorship, but it comes back a lot of the sources over here today about absolute truth and when one can bend the truth for the sake of peace, which everyone agrees is a concept. The Talmud talks about it. I guess the question just is, when can you apply it? So we saw that maybe, truth is an absolute value, but the rabbis can interpret it. When is it appropriate? When is it not? For peace, it's appropriate. Maybe it's only applicable in judicial cases or damage cases, which we understand the truth needs to be heard. But in an everyday case, the Torah wasn't even referring to that. That's more up in the air. So what I think is a very good lesson is what we started with, which is that you see from Beis Hillel that when you praise someone that objectively maybe isn't, so to speak, deserving of the praise, you do it anyway to maintain good relations, that everyone should be positive with one another and only see the good in other people, which is another idea. And if you see the good, then you'll say the good. There's no need to say the bad, even if that's truth. But again, truth, especially by omission, might not be a problem at all. So again, there's more sources, more Talmudic episodes about this topic. We'll rest for now. So have a good day.
Thank you.